So today, as sort of practice from last time, from what we learned in that video that I wasn't here for, and to prepare you for this, we're going to go over 1 Samuel 2 together, which is the context for 1 Samuel 4. I really encourage anyone that's not doing any homework to read 1 Samuel 1 through 4. And if you can, listen to it all like in one setting or read it all in one setting. It's not that long. You could read it in probably 15 minutes. But it really hangs together. And the end of chapter 4 is a really good cliffhanger if you're reading it as a book. And I do recommend stopping there just to feel the weight of everything that's happened up to that point. So, yes, 1 Samuel 1 through 4. I'm going to write that down. Everyone. And as you'll see, as we're doing this little portion today of 1 Samuel 2, 12 to 16, this is just like a, actually, 12 to 26, sorry. This is just a snapshot in the middle of a larger piece. So, let's pray. Dear God, thank you so much for the opportunity to study your word, to hear the stories about you from of old, and the way you are and the way you were. You're the same God yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I ask that we would learn more about you, that we would treat your word with honor and reverence, and that we would just delight in who you are and grow excited about your words. I was reading Psalm 119, and just how delightful your words are and the kind of blessing you bestow on those who delight in your words. So help us to do that today. All right, so let's all open to 1 Samuel 2. 12 to 26, and let's start with just some. Let's read it out loud. Want to do a good reading?
Sure.
Yep. This is 12 to 26. You can start at verse 11. Start at verse 11.
Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli of the priest. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. The custom of the priests with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle, or cauldron, or pot, all that the fork brought up the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, "Give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw." And if the man said to him, "Let them burn the fat first, and then take as much as you wish," he would say, "No, but you must give it. If not, I will take it by force." Thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy clothed with a linen ephod, and his mother used to make for him a little robe and take it to him each year when she went up to with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, "May the Lord give you children by this woman for the petition she asked of the Lord." Then they would return to their home. Indeed, the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and bore 3 sons and 2 daughters. Now the boy Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. 21 or 26?
26. Wait, did I say?
Yeah. 26. Now Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of the meeting. And he said to them, "Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all these people. Oh, my sons, it is no good report that I hear the people of the Lord spreading abroad. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him?" But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. Now the boy Samuel continued to grow in both stature and in favor with the Lord and also with men.
Thank you, Brian. All right. So Sometimes I start by just highlighting and going through it. Sometimes I start with just writing down this data. We're going to start with this today, and then we're going to try to break it up a little bit and figure out a structure that works for us. And if I can figure out that there's an emphasis, something being pushed through, and then we're going to try to get to argument. Ready?
So, yeah.
All right. So, let's talk about place. Where is this and when is this? Place and time. Just going to scan through the passage, just throw out anything you see. We'll just write it on the board, and then we'll try to figure out the best three or four that work.
It's in Shiloh.
Shiloh verse.
And I just remember it.
Yep. This is what they did at Shiloh, verse 14, to all the Israelites. All right, let's talk a little about Shiloh. We heard it in the video last week, but does anyone know anything about Shiloh, either future or past, that of importance?
Well, this was where the ark was located at this time.
Okay, so the ark's located here, that's important, right? So it's the religious center of worship. Center of worship. So this is basically the equivalent of the temple's location, right? The tabernacle's here. What else? I didn't know. I had to go look it up. So if you guys want to use your concordance, you're welcome to.
Is it in Ephraim? Looks like it's in Ephraim.
I can't remember where Ephraim is. So maybe. It's nice to have a map.
I think that's right.
Alright, possibly Ephraim.
It is during the time of the judges.
Good, alright. Time of the judges. Let's flesh that out a little bit. What's going on in the time of the judges?
A lot of apostasy.
Say again?
A lot of apostasy.
A lot of apostasy, right? So, Joshua brought everyone into the land, and he actually divided up the land at Shiloh. So this is the... This is where Joshua divided the land. So it's actually also functioning not just as the religious center, but also kind of like the capital, like John Woodhouse said last week. Joshua divided the land here. Capital city. Such that whatever is happening here is somewhat representative or nationally influencing everything else in the nation. Time of the judges, you said a lot of apostasy, right? That's what I heard. Mm-hmm. So the land gets divided. Do they take the land? How much do they take? Does anyone remember?
Well, they never took it all.
They didn't take it all. They took a good portion of it, right? They didn't take all of it, and they failed. And God said, not take all the land. I would have gone all the way with you, and you stopped. And now, the nations that you did not destroy are going to become thorns in your side, and they're going to tempt you to walk away from God. Because the people in the land were very wicked. They were sacrificing their children. They were doing all kinds of abominations. And God said, this is the reason I'm going to drive them out before you. And this is the reason I want you to annihilate them, because if you don't, they are going to corrupt you, and you're going to follow after them and do the same thing.
I don't remember that. I thought it was, what I vaguely remember is like, where I'm not going to have you kill off all of the people, because otherwise the wild animals would run over you.
He said, I will not defeat them all at once. Otherwise the wild animals will be too much for you. Yes. Okay. But at the beginning of Judges, let's see if I can get it. It's like verse 3. I'm not going to read all of it, but I'll just read snapshots from 2 and 3. I swore to you I would never break my covenant for you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down the altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. What is this that you have done? So now I say, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become thorns in your sides, and their gods shall become a snare to you. Mm-hmm. After that, Joshua dies, the people start serving the Baals, and the Lord begins to raise up judges because he has pity on them. He's kind to them. And he says, because the people have transgressed my covenant and have not obeyed my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died. When Joshua died, he left orders for them to take the rest of the land, and they didn't. So that's where we're at.
Yeah.
Time of apostasy. Anything else?
Well, I did a brief word search for Shiloh.
Yeah. Yes.
And an interesting mention comes up all the way back in Genesis with Israel blessing his sons.
Interesting. What does it say?
The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. This is Genesis 49, verse 10. So in this case, Shiloh appears to be a word referring to the eventual Messiah.
Oh.
And here, right, more clearly, the future kingship. Right? So, back to what you were saying about why, where's this king stuff. Both in Deuteronomy and also there's this idea that a king is going to come first, Shiloh. That's awesome. Anything later that anyone knows?
Yeah, Judges 21.
Okay.
There basically is a feast. They say there's a yearly feast to the Lord that's held at Shiloh. It's when the Benjaminites ambush, like, the virgins.
Oh, yeah. So probably also still supporting the idea that this was a national capital center. For anyone that's doing the study, I recommend reading Psalm 78, 56 to 66. It's very interesting, and it parallels 1 Samuel 4. So I'll write that down. Psalm 78. Honest reading for anyone. 56 to 66. I mentioned Shiloh, and it's kind of explicit, and I'm almost positive it's referring to what happens in 1 Samuel 4. But I figured it out this morning, so I could be wrong. Right. So, also in Jeremiah, he refers back to the events in 1 Samuel 4. So, future context things. All right. So, apostasy also is just kind of chaos, right? So, in Judges, you're hearing the phrase, everyone did what was right in his own eyes a lot because there was no king. So you have a problem in Judges. The problem is there's no king.
Which is ironic because God has already said that he is.
He did say that. Yes. Yep. I can't remember what verse that is. Yes. All right. So those are some of the time period, the plot. What about in this story, 1 Samuel 2? Are there any like good time elements or things that help us track time, or what? When is this happening? Is it at one place? Is it over a period of years? Look at the Bible. Tell me. I will also look. And for anyone that joined in late, we're doing 1 Samuel 2, 12 to 26.
Together. There's enough time has passed that the son's character has been observed and on display.
Okay, so sons, Eli's sons, right? The report has gone out.
Well, talks
temporal? Yep.
It talks about Samuel's mother coming each year, so.
Okay, so this is over a time period of many years.
Or the yearly sacrifice.
Yearly sacrifice. Year to year, right?
Eli was very old.
Good, all right. Time period, Eli is old, which will have significance later, I think.
Hannah, right. I don't know if at this point she had three sons and two daughters, or if it just means in her life she had that, but this is where they put it, is that she had five more kids.
And if you didn't watch the video, the authors like to use time in very dramatic elements like this. So we don't really know if Hannah had children during this time period or 10 years later, but he's putting it in now to show a special contrast. And when the authors put things out of order or drop in a 20-year span, in the middle of a story, it's for a reason, so try to figure out what that reason is. So, what would the reason be here? Why wouldn't they drop it in here?
Well, to show God's blessing to Hannah. You know, she had been barren, and now she's got all these kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, and we'll get back to that when we go through characters. All right, does anyone sort of follow the plot? It's not a normal plot scheme to me. It doesn't feel like it. But let's give it a shot.
Should we do characters or plot first?
I'm okay with jumping to characters. Let's do characters.
I feel like the characters should inform the plot sometimes.
I like it. It's kind of bounce back and forth. Let's do characters. Every character, named or unnamed. Remember, there are three special characters. This is from the video last week. Does anyone remember them?
Narrator.
Narrator, let's drop that in right now.
God himself.
God. Jesus.
Third special character. Who watched the video? You remember? It's the people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the people. All right, what other characters do we have?
Eli and his sons.
Eli.
Are they named here?
I don't know. That's interesting. Sons. I don't think they are.
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Others?
Samuel.
Okay.
Hannah.
Yep.
Her husband, Elkanah.
Yep. Others?
The people who are offering sacrifices.
All right, the people, and we'll specifically say sacrificing.
The women?
Also the people, serving. But it's more specific, yep. The serving women. Good.
Talks about the priest's servant.
Good, yeah. Love it. All right. His sons, priest servant.
Good call.
All right. I'll throw down the priest next to the priest servant. Let's talk about all of these characters. Let's skip the first three for a little bit. Talk about Eli to the priest. Who are they? What role are they playing in the story? What descriptions do we have of them? Let's talk about it. So, you know, as you're just glancing through the story, what's said about them?
Well, Eli's very old.
Old. That's an important line. Remember, character descriptions are not common. So when they're there for a purpose. Any guesses to what that may insinuate or indicate in this passage?
That he may not be with us long. Well, he's yeah. Past his prime. He's sort of losing it a little.
Okay.
I think.
Later we find out that he's judged Israel for 40 years. So he's old. He's going to die soon.
He's had plenty of time to correct his kids. It doesn't appear to do so.
And he's had a long time to correct and restrain his kids. And he hasn't. So all
he
those are important.
Is Eli's wife ever mentioned?
The mom?
It's not, actually. When it is, there's all the time in Kings, they mention the mother. It's very important. It's usually the mother.
So maybe
that's
it's important that she's not mentioned.
Actually, that's probably true.
I think that he's sort of ineffectual because he tries to remonstrate with his kids a little bit, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
But then he blesses Hannah,
mm-hmm.
and she does conceive.
Mm-hmm. So he's still acting in the role of a priest, as the representative of God, and God's actually using him, right?
Yep. He does confront his sons at least once,
verbally at least. But,
right, but
a lot of the stuff they're mentioning here, there would have been specific Levitical laws and punishments that don't appear.
So this is really important. Remember in the video, I don't know if anyone saw it last week. It's not important what I think of the character. that the people that matter, what does God think of the character, and what does the narrator think of the character? Because we don't have all the information, but God does, and he's given it to the narrator. So the characters may get things wrong, right? But when the narrator steps out and says something, we have a clear-cut picture, and we don't need to guess anymore. So at first glance, you're like, seems like Eli's trying. But then God says in the next passage, you did not restrain them. And we get the indication from him being old that he had a long time to do this. And it says things like, he kept hearing, as if this has been going on for a long time. You get this sense that this has been going on. And now that he's old, he's finally taking his last shot. Like, why are you guys doing this stuff? But at that point, Eli has failed as a father in that restraints, and God calls him out for it. We can't really know that from this story until God tells us, though. Because it seems like he's trying. And at this point, it seems like, well, Eli's doing his best, and God just decided, no. But later we find out, no, he wasn't. So. Let's keep going. Others.
Whenever Eli's sons, I'll put that they were strong because they took stuff by force.
I'm going to throw that under the priest's servant because I think the priest's servant is actually the one. He's the enforcer. So the priest's servant shows up. Either they had sort of guards, but the priest's servant is acting as the enforcer. He shows up and takes it, and he says, I'll take it by force. But they have muscle, right? Mm-hmm. Working for them.
Well, the narrator says the sons of Eli were worthless men.
That's really important.
And then at the end, that it was the will of God to put them to death.
And that they would not listen to the voice of their father.
My translation says scoundrels.
Scoundrels.
Worthless. Scoundrels. I love it. Okay, what else do we have?
Did not know the Lord.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I like how they put those in sequence, right? In chapter 3, we're going to find out that Samuel doesn't know the Lord yet. But there's not this connection with Samuel's evil. Right now, it's worthless men did not know the Lord, right in sequence, equating the two. Their problem wasn't primarily that they were scoundrels or worthless. It was that they didn't know God. And because of that, they were worthless.
So that was interesting to me personally, just because I have, you know, in our day, we talk a lot about needing to know the Lord personally, and just because you grew up going to church. And I can remember even praying, and like, what was it back then? Like, was everybody Jewish saved or what? And so I'm seeing it here. No, it was the same thing back then.
Yeah.
That you needed to know the Lord personally. Just being Jewish wasn't like your ticket into heaven,
right,
or something. And I just didn't know that in the Old Testament they talked about it like that.
Yeah.
And they do.
I love this passage. I have a very personal connection because I had a friend that I wanted to take through the Bible, didn't know where to start, and he's like, well, just tell me about the Bible. I'm like, all right. So I just started like generalizing, like botching it totally. And so there's these books about this, and I got to the Psalms, and I was like, half of them were written by this king, and I was talking about David, and he's like, I want to hear more about David. I'm like, all right, first, sure. You've never read the Bible, let's start in 1 Samuel. So we did. We started 1 Samuel as his first introduction to hearing about God.
And or ever reading the Bible, right?
Ever reading the Bible. And it was awesome. It was awesome. He was hearing things about God so clearly from here. It was like the nature of repentance, who's in and who's not in, what God sees and doesn't see, forgiveness, repentance, how God is patient, how God gives Eli like three shots through the report, through a messenger, to a final messenger, and Eli doesn't even do anything with it. And the final messenger, he says, he sticks with the passive mode. God will do whatever he's going to do. And it's interesting, he uses what's in Hannah's song as beautiful and glorious, or no, Psalms, God is in the heavens, he does whatever he pleases, and he uses it to sort of excuse his own passivity. Whereas the Ninevites are like, we're doomed in 40 days? We're wearing sackcloth, we're going to ask forgiveness, and we're going to hope on the mercy of God. And he doesn't. So, anyways, he heard so many good things about God in the first 3 or 4 chapters of Samuel. It was really great. And that excited me about the Bible. It's like, man, he's all over the pages of it. It's not just one spot. Anyways, so let's keep going. Samuel, Juana, O'Connor, priest.
Samuel, do you think?
No, it's for
but it's how Samuel was long.
It's going to fit.
Since Samuel was ministering before the Lord.
Okay. So what role is he playing?
As
if he's Eli's son, he has the ephod on. So he's acting in a priestly role. And I think, did a little research on this, Samuel is actually descended from one of the sons of the Levites. A little research on that. I don't know if it's important or not. Probably not. But
well, it would have been important because he could not act as a priest.
Yeah, he should not have if he wasn't, but he was. So.
And remember, they gave a genealogy for Hannah's husband.
Yes, so I went to that. That took me to Chronicles. That took me to Exodus. And assuming the names are the same and they're not repeated, was a different genealogy than he was. But, you know, they use a lot of the same names. So.
There it is, yeah.
Ministering in a priestly role, right? Okay. Hannah, Elkanah, anything important about Elkanah going on?
Oh, we're going to go back to Samuel for a second.
Do it.
He was a boy.
Yes. Great.
He was not a man. I loved how it says the mother used to make him a little robe. Can you see like a three-year-old, you know, has a little robe?
Well, it was interesting to see like the difference between the two parents, you know?
Yeah, but yeah. Samuel's basically being raised by Eli.
Yeah.
That's really important, right? He's raised in this environment, in a terrible environment.
That would scare me if I was Hannah.
Oh, man.
Like, that's how you raise your sons? What have I done?
I think what's beautiful about this, right, is why didn't he end up that, like, Eli's sons? And we have, from Hannah, God will guard the feet of his faithful ones.
Mm-hmm.
And in a bad environment, with bad parents, bad brothers in law, so to speak, not really, or, you know, stepbrothers, so to speak, adopted. God's protecting him.
There's another thing I noticed here. At the very end it says, now the boy Samuel continued to grow both in stature and in favor with the Lord and also with man. And the Gospel of Luke says almost exactly the same thing about
Jesus.
After his parents find him in the temple, and he says, did you not know I had to be in my father's house? Right at the end of that passage, it says, and Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the parallel language is pretty interesting there.
I think it is interesting, yep. In God's house, right?
Yes.
So Jesus is being connected with Samuel in his priestly role, very quite possibly. All right, father's house, right? That's what he said?
It's in the context of that passage, yeah.
Yep.
Did you not know I must be in my father's house?
Okay. I think Elkanah's kind of the wash minor character, unless anyone disagrees, I don't know. All right, so.
Well, it does say that he goes back to their town.
All right.
I mean, it just mentioned specifically.
So he's traveling with Hannah.
Elkanah went home to Ramah.
Let's throw Rama as another place.
I guess it's implied that Hannah goes with him.
I used to live here, you know. You're gonna die here, you know.
All right. Let's talk a little about foils and plot. So, any foils that you guys see here?
Well, Eli's son and sons and Samuel.
Yeah. Foil. Very strong between Eli's sons and Samuel. Prove it. Let's back it up. I totally agree. Let's just get something
raised
right.
By Eli, but they're
both raised by Eli.
Favor versus non-favor. Like the report was not favorable that he hears about, and he's like, Samuel's growing in stature and in favor.
I think it's very important. Eli's sons are falling out of favor with God and the people. In the story, and Samuel is growing in favor with other people. So, growing, falling out of, right? Favor. Right, because the report's going abroad, everyone's hearing about it, right? But everyone's also hearing about Samuel.
I wonder what he did to grow in favor.
That's a good question. I don't know.
It says Samuel was ministering before the Lord, and the two sons were not ministering before the Lord. They were defacing the temple, I guess.
So Samuel is doing their job. Samuel, not going to be a priest originally, ends up in the priestly role, doing the priestly thing and ministering. Eli's sons, born to do it, are failing at it. So yeah, you have a lot of strong foil connections. Very opposite, contrasting. Let's talk about Zap and Tail. How does the story start and end? What's happened from the beginning to the end?
Well, I was going to just say, I think that Eli and Hannah are foils.
That's a really good one. I love it. I didn't see that. That's great.
I'll support that.
As parents, right? Hannah is coming up to the sacrifice every single year, right?
But also, I was going to say, so Eli, you know, he's the judge of Israel. And Hannah, she's a barren woman. So, you know, just very much their status.
Yeah. Hannah's got nothing status-wise. Eli's got everything. Yeah. This is great.
Chad?
Yep.
Just for clarity, foil, is that a negative context?
Foil, is it a what?
I wouldn't say it's negative. It's usually literary.
Kind of it's a literary feature to compare two characters and sort of, they're so opposite, one highlights the other. a really good obvious example in literature, and I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's a literary feature. To basically, one character's degeneracy highlights the other one's goodness. But it doesn't have to be in that sort of negative context. It could be anything. Okay. One person's richness, like in The Tale of Two Cities, highlights the other person's wealth. It's a way of making one character seem like something because of... They do it in movies all the time. They make the bad guy really, really bad, so that the good guy seems a little better, you know?
I mean, one example would be Aslan and the White Witch from Narnia. Similar roles, but contrasting.
Yeah, and they'll do that. They'll do similar roles, similar characteristics, similar categories to make you feel like they're supposed to be the same, but they're more opposite. Like, you know, Eli and Hannah are both parents, or they're both raising a child, so to speak, in a sense. All right, so we have a lot of information. Let's try to break down a structure. If you guys were sort of reading this as a play or as a narrative, where do you think the first break would be?
Right after Mary's talking about Eli's sons and begins talking about Samuel.
Verse
18.
Mm-hmm. Anyone want to contest that or support it with more detail?
What about verse 11?
Included or excluded? Like as its own scene or?
I didn't realize we were going back to verse 11.
I kind of left it optional. So I don't know. It feels like it belongs to both stories to some extent, right? It's like setting up the next one.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say in the middle of verse 11, Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest, so you have a division of locations.
I don't feel like we have to say this verse belongs to this section, and this one belongs to that section. The Bible can be seamless enough to throw into both, right? It's possible.
Well, the verses didn't exist in the original text. Either.
Exactly. So we can break the sentence wherever we want. We can break it in the middle of a verse if it feels like it flows that way.
I would almost say that 11 and 12 are maybe kind of background, because it immediately sets up the contrast between Samuel and Eli's sons.
Mm-hmm. So we'll say 11 or 11b to verse 17. And let's try to describe this section. What's going on between 11 and 17? If you were to kind of sum it up in three or four words or five, you know, a phrase.
Cooking.
That's it. Let's find a way to stick it in there. We'll do it. Cooking practices of Eli.
So Eli's worthless sons are extorting from the offerings.
Okay.
The title of the cookbook should be Shiloh's Finest.
Somewhere in here, right, we have the word offering. We have to have the word Eli's sons or the priests. Probably Eli's sons because they're called out. Okay. And what else? And their sin. What did somebody say?
Maybe a large chunk of that, basically 13 through 17, is literally just providing examples for why they were worthless.
Yeah.
And is extortion, is that the right word for what they're doing?
I don't think they were taking money, but yeah, they were. I don't know what extortion exactly means. Yeah.
So there's a disdain for the sacrifice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they give a lot of time to this cooking.
Right.
I mean, it's very detailed of what we're supposed to be doing.
I mean, later you find out that they're sleeping around with the temple ladies, too.
Yeah.
And you think, okay, well, why didn't you elaborate on that?
Right. Why isn't that the big deal?
Right.
The one that's against God, and the other is against people, specifically.
Both are called out, but specifically, their position, they should have known and been handling God's sacrifice with absolute reverence and awareness.
Yes.
I'm not going to give this a shot because this deserves 5 or 10 minutes of thinking, and I really recommend that whoever's preparing, you get your data, you figure out where your break is, and then you just try to boil it, condense it down. What are the most important things happening in the sentence? And write it. Cooking.
Words.
Boil it.
Oh,
yep.
What's
that?
Boil it down.
All right. Does anyone know why this was so bad or anything like that? Do we have any background? Any sort of context?
Well, the
Jeff.
I think. Sorry. Well, you have the historical context. I mean, the very obvious Levitical law specifically stated that the fat and the entrails were always consumed in the offerings.
All fat is the Lord's, is actually a direct quote.
And at least from cultural significance in that time, that's what you would typically offer to your God, because that was the best of the animal.
Yep. There were offerings you eat, offerings you didn't eat. In either case, all the fat goes to God. In the case of eating it, the people would have their own food, right? They would eat their offering. But in this case, and the breast and the thigh would go to the priest. But now you have these guys coming in with a fork, and you can just imagine the fork getting bigger and bigger each year, comically, and then being like, whoops, got the whole thing, and you know, walking away with it. It's easy to imagine this scene, right? And the people that have come there to worship, what's going on? Like, why, you know? So, let's go to 18. What's the next break? 18 to...
I'm going to say 18 to 21A, and mainly because at the end of 21 it says, and the boy Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord, and then later on it says in verse 26, now the boy Samuel continued to grow in both stature and favor the Lord and also with man. So I feel like that's either, it's going to either be bracketing something or it's going to be like a repeated.
And why are you guys breaking it where you're breaking it? For those that are just a little lost, why are you breaking it here? What's changed that makes you feel like here's the spot?
Sounds simple.
That doesn't focus growth.
And Tom?
Yeah, I was saying there's a period of growth from verse 21. So to break it there, I think, makes sense than going into 22 and making it seem as though it's just.
Okay, you have a time of growing.
What, 18, Valerie? It starts from, instead of talking about Eli and the sons, he starts talking about Samuel.
It's a different character, it's a different subject, good. Jeff, you got something?
But I know that one of the tricks you've been using recently is like you pair verses.
Okay.
And this actually pairs up really well because you have Samuel at the very beginning in 18.
Yeah.
Paired with Samuel in 21b. Hannah in 19, paired with Hannah in 21, and then Eli in the middle.
Interesting. What happens in the middle with Eli?
He's blessing Hannah.
Interesting. Okay. Might be something. Find a chiasm everywhere. Let's have fun. I enjoy this. If you guys want to stick around for two more minutes, I appreciate it. If not, I understand. Everyone has kids, especially. Samuel ministering, Samuel growing, right? Now, what's happening here? It's not really Eli, it's God, right? God's blessing Hannah through Eli's words. So that hidden character in the story, God's the one that visits. I don't know how to use this bird. Visits Hannah and blesses her. Okay, and then we'll just say 22 to the end. If you start breaking it up this way, you start seeing interesting things. Like throughout the story, from the top to the middle to the bottom, Samuel is getting highlighted, but as a background character. If you're seeing the scenes, right, it's almost like Samuel's sweeping the temple in the background while the priests are taking the forks and everything else. And I think it's supposed to be that way, right? In this section, the sins of Eli's sons and Eli are detailed. In the next section, you're going to get a direct prophet who basically says, this is what I'm going to do to your house. And all this while Samuel, while Eli's house is getting rejected, God is preparing for himself a priest to take the place temporarily for Eli's sons. And he's the first of at least two fulfillments, three, of the next section where God says, I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. And Samuel, for a time, fulfills that role. Then it goes to Zadok, I think, and then it goes to Jesus, and maybe some other people in between there.
Kind of similar to Saul versus David.
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Good connection. That's great.
All right. So start looking for those pieces. So right in the middle of all of this sin, you have God blessing Hannah and God preparing throughout the story a priest for himself. So that might be the emphasis, that in the midst of wickedness and all the leaders and all the bad people that should be doing good, God is preparing for himself somebody who will be faithful to do what he wants. That could be an emphasis, and it could be part of the argument. And we've seen it just by sort of categorizing. I know I've done it fairly poorly here, but this is all really good stuff for 4. I hope you have fun next week for Samuel 4. I'm looking forward to your presentation.